Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party Network. Every 2 weeks we journey through the A24 filmography, two films at a time, and in between we try and bring you interviews with the talent involved in front of and behind the camera. Joining me as ever is Dallas King, and in this episode we'll be looking at The Souvenir and The Last Black Man in San Francisco. So welcome back, Dallas.
Good to be back, as always. How are you?
Yeah, good. It's still in lockdown, still no new A24 films to be announced or to look forward to. So, yeah, it's frustrating. It's kind of getting a bit boring now. And when their latest movie to enjoy on the TV is Scoob, I'm desperate for some sort of First Cow or The Green Knight to come on.
Yeah, I think they've done it on purpose to allow us to catch up and, you know, then be on an even keel with them and, you know, review films as they come out, I think.
Yeah.
If they put us on a screener list, of course, so we can watch them when they come out in America rather than have to wait a year to come out in the UK.
One can dream. I mean, usually in sort of the past few weeks, or should I say 2 months now, A24 Hour News has been sort of a desert really for us, but we were kind of amusingly, sort of when we recorded our last episode, we were kind of like, right, that's it, another episode in the bag, and usually A24 Hour News sorts of spills out afterwards. In this case, it was actually us that kind of became viral, sort of our second one in as many weeks. Our interview with David Lowry sort of started appearing on websites around the globe, from IndieWire to La Première in France, about him being unsure what the future lies for sort of The Green Knight, whether it's cinemas, VOD. Very much people made headlines out of, yeah, I don't know, we'll find out. Which is quite incredible, probably quite telling about modern journalism. So yeah, we made the news.
I know, it was crazy to see. It was like, David Lowry gives an update, and I go, oh well, he's got an update, I'll click on that and go, hang on, this sounds all very familiar. And then it was like the A24 Project, and I was like, hey, that's us. And then of course you click on another bit of news and they just call it the A24 Podcast, and I'm like, oh, hang on now. No. Check your sources. And I think most of the rest of the evening was, I think both of us were sort of tweeting various websites going, I think you'll find it's actually the A24 Project podcast. Could you please update it and link to us and stuff like that? That'd be great. And eventually it seems they did, because we did get quite a lot of hits on that episode, I think. So it was totally worth it.
Yeah. It's certainly proven to be one of our most popular ones. So yeah, we've certainly taken a lot of extra listeners on. So you know, if you're tuning in for the second or third time since then, it's a pleasure to have you on. Yeah, it was quite surreal to sort of see us being sort of mentioned around the world, and it was pretty crazy, really. But yeah, kind of nice to see sometimes. You know, there was I thought it was like the most sort of dullest part of the interview, of like, hey, something might happen. Who knows? When I thought, I was like, oh, like that bit would have been made a good article, or like that was a funny anecdote, but yeah, what can you do?
Yeah, no, it's clickbait. He's like, hey, the update is there is no update, you know, which has actually been us for A24 News the last couple of episodes. So it's always a bit odd now, but you know, it was nice. And I think everyone can expect many more headliner style short clips to appear on social media in the future, I think, if this one's anything to go by.
Definitely. I mean, this is one of those things, this is our most kind of bumper A24 Hour News in a little while. One thing we were kind of talking about a few weeks ago, we kind of spoke about, like, oh, A24 Hour TV, we will eventually discuss it in some form or for another, but we were always kind of talking about this Under the Skin TV series. And in the battle between Silver Reel and A24, Silver Reel has won. So they've kind of won the rights to sort of do a television spin-off of Jonathan Glazer's cult sci-fi film Under the Skin, which was obviously an adaptation of a book as well. So we will not be able to discuss the Under the Skin, the TV series, in the future. Sad face.
Oh, I mean, you just got and made our news article from a couple of weeks ago completely redundant now.
I know, there's something to be said about podcasts that don't do news and are just like completely timeless. Like, I was thinking like the other day when we were talking about like Untitled Ari Aster sequel, and now it's like, get people listening back going, oh, that was Midsummer skit, you know. So yeah, unfortunately our kind of, this is something that's been popping up in the news for us, is now going to be removed from the news segments for the future.
Well, I think people do like to, it shows that, you know, we are trying to be as topical as we can, and we're, you know, I think, did you say, I think at one point we actually overtook the A24 podcast on one of the charts. So, you know, we are potentially becoming the place to go to for A24 news. So, you know,
yeah,
we're building that sort of niche following.
So we do have some TV news we can talk about. So Oliver Assayas, the writer-director of things like Personal Shopper, The Clouds of Sales Marie, is adapting his 1996 movie Irma Vep, all about a Chinese movie actress in France who stars in a remake of Les Vampires and finds petty intrigues and clashing egos on set. So this is a film I've not had the chance to see yet, but it's going to be adapted into a television project for A24. So yeah, this is another encouraging sign that we'll come to the TVs eventually. What did you make of this news, Dallas?
It's certainly intriguing. I mean, this guy, I've loved what he's done in the past, especially, like you say, Clouds of Sales Marie and Personal Shopper. So anything that he does in the future now, I'm in. I expect to see a Kristen Stewart cameo in there somewhere at some point. So, intrigued to see what's. And yeah, I think I think we're about six episodes away until we're sort of caught up with the A24 catalogue in terms of films. So looking forward to diving in and checking out the likes of Euphoria and Rami and stuff like that. And, you know, it gives us another string to the arsenal.
Absolutely. I haven't seen the film either, but I'm kind of a fan of his work, so I'm definitely going to kind of dive into this one in sort of the lockdown and see kind of how it might turn into a TV show. Unfortunately, there was sort of sad news as well this week as well with the passing of Lynn Shelton. So she was the director of a film that we kind of reviewed kind of quite early on, Laggies. She sadly passed away due to a blood disorder. So, you know, she mixed mumblecore movies like Hump Day, Outside In, Your Sister's Sister, with TV shows like The Mindy Project, Mad Men, Glow, and Fresh Off the Boat. So sad to see sort of one of our kind of first A24 filmmakers we kind of got to speak about has passed away. So yeah, kind of that was some sad news over the weekend alongside sort of Fred Willard.
Yeah, and it was really sad because I think we were maybe not overly effusive in praise in Say When, but it certainly did have its moments. And she's certainly a filmmaker which I found really interesting. Your Sister's Sister is probably one of my favourites of hers, but I've also started, I think you watched it over the weekend, and I've got it queued up on Netflix at the moment to watch the next couple of days, is Outside In, which is the only film of hers on Netflix. But I expect, due to the sad news, I think maybe some more of her back catalogue will be making an appearance so people can go out and find it, because she has a great touch with the actors and also a keen ear for dialogue and stuff like that. And yeah, it's a sad day. And I mean, she was one certainly that I've sort of found over the last couple of years with due to the sort of 52 films by women as well, so I've been introduced to a lot of them like that way. So sad news indeed.
Yeah, I kind of finished my 52 films with Outside In on Saturday. So yeah, that was a really kind of enjoyable film as well. So yeah, a real shame to kind of lost such a kind of bright star of indie cinema. So yeah, our thoughts are kind of with our loved ones and family at this time. But you know, next week we'll have an interview actually to, you know, as well. So we're going to be joined by Alana White to talk about her role in First Reformed. So we heard a bit of a mini preview kind of good few months ago when we sort of did our First Reformed episode. So we're going to drop the full interview next week. So here's a little preview of that. What was the kind of feedback you were getting from like Ethan and Paul on your performance?
So, I mean, both Ethan and Paul were delightful. Ethan was so complimentary. He also sat there for, I believe, if I remember correctly, every single take of ours, even the ones that he wasn't in the background for. And he really didn't have to do that. I've worked with big names where they just sat in their trailer until they were called on set. They were nice enough, but we had no interaction at all. Ethan was there in the back of that church watching us sing every single tape, which was just so cool. And it felt so amazing that if somebody like Ethan Hawke could sit there and take in your performance and respect you as an artist. And after every single take, he was like, you guys sound awesome. It's really, really lovely to watch you guys. And the same with Paul. Paul was very complimentary and just seemed really happy with the outcome. And you know, it was a lot of trust. It's like, we trust you guys to blindly learn the song and to come in and to do your work. And, you know, we trusted them to give us a very safe, secure working environment. And it really was. It was everything that you could possibly want it to be.
That, as someone that loves the Before trilogy, knowing that Ethan Hawke is one of the good guys is music to my ears. That's a yes. huge takeaway for me.
Yes, yeah, he really was. He really was. And I mean, not even in one of those ways where, you know, he wasn't even standoffish. He was so participatory. It was very, very, very cool to see, because you really never know which way it's going to go. And yeah, he really was one of the good guys.
So there we go. So it's such a relief to know that Ethan Hawke is one of cinema's good guys. He's not just looks like a good guy on screen, but a good guy to kind of work with and worth on screen as well.
I know. I was very, very jealous of the Nerd Party's Shawnee Stritch when he got to have a brief moment with him at the Sundance Film Festival. Ethan Hawke is probably up there in my top three, potentially top one of actors that I would love to be able to sit down and interview. So, you know, fingers crossed one day we might be able to get him on for a full episode of the A24 project.
Yeah, that's definitely the dream. So in this episode, we're going to look at The Souvenir and The Last Black Man in San Francisco. First up is The Souvenir. So Julie, a young film student in the early 1980s in the UK, becomes romantically involved with a complicated and untrustworthy man, Anthony. Written and directed by Joanna Hogg, when did you first see this one, Dallas, and what were you expecting going in?
I think I first saw this film with you at the Edinburgh International Film Festival of it was just last year. It seems like it's so long ago to be able to attend a film festival, but yeah, it was last year. I didn't know much about it going in. I was familiar with Joanna Hogg's work, the sort of likes of Archipelago and stuff. So I knew she was very sort of minimalist, sort of British kitchen sink, sort of family drama sort of side of things. But this was the one where she'd been tapped up by executive producer Martin Scorsese and, you know, picked up by A24. So, you know, obviously it hits up on my radar. The likes of being involved with Tilda Swinton, you know, fantastic actress, very keen on her, and the debut of her daughter, Honor Swinton-Byrne. So yeah, it was all very interesting. Didn't know much about the plot, as I think will become clear when we get to discuss it. There was some elements that were a bit surprising, but I was really looking forward to seeing this. I think it'd be fair to say that reaction on the way out of the film was potentially mixed from some critics and stuff like that, but I think that's maybe due to the fact that it is potentially just awfully posh. What about yourself?
Yeah, as you kind of mentioned, I saw this one with you. I was kind of quite excited to see this one. It was a sort of frustrating lineup at Edinburgh Film Festival last year, but this was one of sort of the standouts for me, an A24 film. I wasn't really familiar with Joanna Hogg's work at that point in time. I was really excited to see sort of Tilda Swinton in anything. I'm always not too sure what I'm going to expect, what planet she's going to be from, what age she's going to be. So it was always kind of something quite exciting going in. And I really liked the trailers as well. And I'm an absolute sucker for sort of films about sort of the rich upper class and sometimes their sort of worries and woes that they get up to in life. So yeah, this was one I was really looking forward to. But for months going into sort of the film festival, I think it kind of had, I started to hear murmurings kind of out of the Berlin Film Festival, and people I trust and respect were kind of very mixed on it, to say the least. There was people I was listening to that were kind of critiquing it from, well, I am a working class film critic, and I find this film offensive for all these various reasons. So it's, you think like that, you think, ooh, interesting. And then you hear some people on the other divide. There seemed to be like a lot of discourse going on sort of among critics, which is kind of rare, because sometimes it's more like, what's the public saying? What are people having to say about this? This felt like it was kind of playing out online. And yeah, it had me very, very kind of curious. And I was like, well, I'm pretty sure I'm going to like this. This seems my kind of thing. But I can see this being one where when you catch up with your friends after a screening, and you know, one that there's not going to be sort of a uniform kind of opinion on. And I think, as you touched on there, Dallas, it was one that sort of did split opinion when we all came out of it, you know, June last year.
Yeah, it did seem to split opinion, but I'm pretty sure I was looking at the figures and stuff before coming on here, and it, you know, for the published critic wise, I think it was universally praised pretty much. I think it had about 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm pretty sure the audience one, there's probably a big split between the critics and the audience on this one. But, you know, it was a very well accomplished film. But I think there probably is some barriers to their enjoyment or potential to relate to certain characters, perhaps, in it. I think that might be the barrier to entry for many people in that.
Yeah, I think that can be a challenge, because I always find it one of these ones that I think whenever we discuss films we like and love and what ones are our favourite at the end of the year, I don't know about you, but for me personally, it's always like, it's not a case of being objective, it's like what spoke to me, my personal taste and interest, because I'm not here to sort of give an opinion on, like, objectively speaking, this is a great film or this is better than that. You know, ultimately this was one I enjoyed the characters and the quirks of it, and it felt like it was something that I would love to kind of, you know, repeatedly watch, and I've kind of watched it a few times since. So yeah, I think for certain critics it's that objective kind of thing is the way to go, but I think more and more, especially with sort of the kind of advance of blogging, it is that personal opinion, and you know, it can be very difficult, rightly or wrongly, to sort of remove yourself from how you resonated with a film, as opposed to taking a step back. Maybe there's a kind of more, you know, the traditional film critics come from that background of, I'm going to remove Robbie Collin or, you know, Mark Kermode or, you know, whoever from the picture. I'm going to objectively do it as sort of a historian of films and so on, and put that opinion. And I think that's something that, you know, again, it has its pros and its cons that, you know, bloggers, podcasters, etc., aren't as likely to do. And, I don't want that to sound like a criticism of either ways of thinking.
Yeah, no, I mean, this one, I mean, when I didn't review it for the website I normally review for, because I think there was just so many films coming out at that time, and I don't think it had got a confirmed release date at that point, so I was maybe focusing on other films. But sort of on my Letterboxd review, I mean, I think I definitely gave it a 4 out of 5 after my first watch, because I thought it was very well made. I thought the performances, particularly the central two performances of Honor and Tom Burke, were exceptional. And yeah, but I think it's like you say, when you get to the end of the year and you're looking at your top 10 list for the year, I tend to go with, well, what were the films that made an impression on me? What were my favourite and most enjoyable films of the year, as opposed to what were technically the most 10 most accomplished films? Because yeah, I think 4 out of 5, very well made, but it never was probably really in serious consideration for my top 10 of that year, even though it was very well made. I think on rewatch, I think I maybe had slightly more issues with it, and therefore it made me drop down to about a 3. But I mean, it doesn't take anything away from the filmmaker. It's just I think even on second viewing, I think there was perhaps more of a bit of a disconnect between myself and the characters. But I think we could probably get into that. I mean, this, you know, if anything, this is the film, you know, which it does get bonus points for being the film which brings Richard Ayoade into the A24 universe. So
yeah, so we'll kind of go with the constructive criticism first. What were some of those issues on the repeat viewing that kind of stood out for you this time?
I mean, one issue is one that I had on the first one, but it was such a bit of a shock to me that it probably didn't sort of resonate quickly enough, is the fact that this film is set in the 80s, and particularly around the time of the Troubles. Having not really seen the trailer or read anything about the film, for about the first half hour, I thought it was just a modern day film, like shot on 16mm or something like that, and that when people were using their 35mm cameras and typing up their film scripts on a typewriter, I just thought they were hipsters. And therefore, I was quite shocked when at one point, I think there's a photo of Tom Burke with a beard, and he says, oh, that was me in Afghanistan in 73, and I'm like, No, I couldn't have said 73 because, you know, if this was two, that would make him about 60. He's not 60. But then they started talking about the Troubles and I went, oh, right, this is set in the 80s. And I've just been incredibly stupid and not realised that. But I think a few other people I spoke to afterwards were in the same boat, that they hadn't realised that it was a period set film. But, so, I mean, that was that issue. But, I mean, it sort of managed to sort of dissipate. But I think it was just, it was really that sort of emotional disconnect with the characters. I mean, it's difficult. It's a difficult situation because you're dealing with a woman who is in a relationship which is clearly quite toxic. He's very manipulative. He's probably emotionally abusive, not physically, but emotionally. He's dealing with a heroin addiction, stuff like that. And it's sometimes you're sort of screaming at her, just leave him, just dump him. But obviously, you know, I've never been in that type of situation, so I mean this, it's very complex and there's very reasons why, you know, someone would stay with that. And it's just, I would have almost liked a bit more sort of scenes, maybe of just her on her own trying to sort of comprehend where she's at emotionally and stuff like, because sometimes it did seem a bit sort of at arm's length and a bit too distant to really be able to emotionally connect with the characters. I think it was more of a study of a relationship rather than really getting in close to it, and I think a lot of that sort of compounded to me towards the end, where, you know, she's a film student and they're shooting this film, and at the end she sort of turns and looks directly at the camera, and then there's a scene where in the film studio the door opens and sort of she walks out. It's almost like to say the film is over. It's like, it's almost like the filmmaker was making a film and we're now aware of that. It wasn't, it felt like it wasn't a true look at a relationship. It was a film's look at a relationship of how that could, it's like a filmic study of it. Maybe not sort of autobiographical or even semi-autobiographical, but it just came off slightly too much of an emotional disconnect, I think, for me, second time around.
Yeah, I find I personally don't have an issue with that myself. I do kind of like that sort of coldness, and I've discovered that sort of kind of diving into sort of Johanna Hogg's sort of filmography after the fact. I think MUBI put up a lot of her films sort of in the past sort of 12 months, is that they are very kind of cold and distant with these relationships. You sort of feel like you're eavesdropping in on it and you don't get the opportunity to sort of learn about these characters. You just get sort of an insight and then we can all go off and discuss afterwards what we thought about maybe these toxic relationships and so on. I think with some of the other films I watched from sort of Johanna Hogg, I think those haven't been as successful as A Souvenir. With that, those kind of the other films, I was like, oh, I don't really find these sort of characters necessarily the most interesting in the world or the setup. Whereas I was sort of really into sort of this, more so as that sort of period piece and sort of just watching these kind of, you know, characters. I thought Anthony was sort of, you know, intentionally or not, quite an amusing sort of character, quite tragic. And I think with sort of Julie is this sort of, you know, someone that's sort of pushed around and sort of just watching her, and it was just something that was quite alien, that people that could sort of hand out kind of money willy-nilly, that, you know, she has this apartment in sort of King's Road, London. It was something I was really interested in, sort of, oh, this is how they live and interact and sort of what's going on in sort of high society as well, sort of for like very upper class kind of the world, and her journey as a filmmaker and sort of how she was prodded sort of, well, why do you want to make this film about people up north and so on. I found it all kind of, you know, much more interesting. And as you say, sort of Richard Ayoade's sort of appearance as well, you know, all these kind of little colourful characters would drop in every so often. So I was always sort of quite engaged with the film, and I personally really enjoyed it more than I have sort of other Johanna Hogg films, which were sometimes maybe only getting like a couple of stars or maybe 3 out of 5 when I was kind of rating on them on Letterboxd. So, you know, I can certainly see why she would be a divisive filmmaker. It's, you know, I'm fine with that kind of coldness, but I can see for a lot of the public why that would be unappealing.
Yeah, no, it's a particular style, and like you say, it's not going to be for everyone, but I mean, I can see the merits of it, especially when it is so well played by the two actors. I think Honor has got a great career ahead of her. It's, I mean, like you say, yeah, there's got quite a bit of interest into why almost you don't get as much of the reasons why she's doing it. Like you say, it's got an interesting one that why someone from this quite obviously privileged background is wanting to go up north, as they would say, and film the town of Sunderland, which was another reason why I didn't sort of initially click that it was set in the 80s. I thought when she was sort of looking at the, and this is no offence to the town of Sunderland, it's like when she was sort of saying that, you know, it's a town in ruins, I thought maybe it still is. And it hadn't moved back on since, you know, since the 80s. So therefore, maybe that was introduced. The decision to shoot in 16mm black and white was an artistic choice. But, you know, what's interesting about this film is that it is, you know, in a situation where there's apparently, you know, there's enough in it that A24, you know, want more, and we're looking at a situation where we're going to get The Souvenir Part 2. I mean, are you excited for this?
Yes. I remember sort of like knowing sort of the sequel was coming when we went into our first screening, and I was kind of curious of where it would kind of go, and I don't know if it will be sort of a before sort of Sunset style thing where it will be several years into the future or how it follows. I was really gutted that Robert Pattinson, who was going to be starring in it, fortunately due to sort of, I think it was extra footage that needed to be shot or reshots for Tenant, fortunately had to drop out. I would have loved to have seen him in this world and sort of continue his streak of A24 films.
I know he would have been great in it, but you know, apparently he's so good that instead of Robert Pattinson, they had to get two actors, and they had to split the role between two people because it takes two actors to fill the boots of one Robert Pattinson these days in the world of A24. But I think we're probably looking at a situation where it's probably maybe sort of 5-10 years on from her. She's probably become maybe a successful filmmaker, maybe she's even sort of made a film about that relationship or something. So I think it's going to be interesting to see where it goes and maybe how Joanne Hogg's style adapts to a film which is going to be set potentially, is it going to be in the 90s, is it going to be in sort of modern day? It's really interesting to know where it's going to go. But you know, it's, if you look at the back catalogue of A24, this probably wasn't, you know, the one that people would have picked first as that's the one that's definitely going to get a sequel.
No, I think it's going to be a very interesting film. It seems to be very quiet what's kind of happening with that kind of film. I don't know when it's coming out. I kind of anticipated it would maybe drop for sort of London Film Festival, but I would suspect it's going to be kind of rolling into 2021 at this rate, and yeah, it's going to be a long wait to see what this film is going to be. I imagine it's just probably just being edited during sort of lockdown at the moment.
Yeah, no, I think from the time when Robert Pattinson had to drop out and they were continuing on, I think it's probably all filmed now. I think you could probably, since it's A24, they're going to be looking to clear the shelves a bit of all the releases which are stacking up. So there's a chance maybe Sundance London next year, perhaps, sort of end of May time, we might be able to get that. Hopefully, if it goes ahead, I'll definitely be trying to attend next year. So I'd say probably around about that time. It's a good fit for that type of festival, so fingers crossed. But yeah, very excited to see where they go with this. Will it be as posh? I don't know, but
I should say one thing before we move on is I think this film has some of the funniest moments I had in the cinema last year. We can talk about being quite cold with relationships, but as you kind of touched on, sort of the Richard Ayoade bit where he starts this kind of like stoner, you know, kind of just very sort of like
giant, I'd love to know, sheepskin jacket thing that he's got on.
Yeah. Yeah, like he's kind of diving into a relationship of like how, what, why, what's going on here. I thought he absolutely stole the show with that scene. It's one of the funniest sort of A24 scenes, I think. And I love the delivery. And I mean, I'm pretty sure I laughed out loud when I saw it in the cinema, but it's just the line delivery of like Anthony and Julie are getting down to it underneath the covers, and just Tom Burns' delivery of, "Oh, Julie, you are a dark horse," I just thought was the funniest thing and stuff like that. I think this has got some underrated comedy in it.
Yeah, no, that line in particular, that got a huge laugh in the audience, and it was even the title episode for our Edinburgh Festival recap episode as well. I think you put it in, but yeah, no, Iowari stole the show for me. I think it's one of those one scene wonder cameos that, you know, he's just great in. And you know, A24, give the man some money. I want him to make a film for A24. You know, The Double was brilliant, Submarine was great, so he's definitely a filmmaker who would absolutely 100% fit in with the brand of A24. So yeah, please make his next role a director.
So moving on to our next film, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, Jimmy Fails dreams of reclaiming the Victorian home his grandfather built in the heart of San Francisco. Joined in his quest by his best friend, Mont, Jimmy searches for the belonging in a rapidly changing city that seems to have left him behind. So Dallas, when did you first see this and what was your expectations going in?
Again, it was one which I knew a little bit about, so in terms of quality, I had no real expectations. It was at the London Film Festival and I wanted to go see it. When I got down there, I was worried I wasn't going to get to see it because for some reason, London Film Festival, unlike Edinburgh, their press screening seemed to take about 2 or 3 days ahead of the screening, and there's only one chance to see them, and I arrived after that one, and then pretty much all the screenings were sold out, but I managed to get a rush ticket on very last minute, and then saw the first screening at the Curzon Mayfair, I think it was, which was attended by director Joe Talbot and also pretty much, I think, the majority of the cast outside of Danny Glover. I think they brought their whole entourage over. It was like, yeah, do you want to come over to London Film Festival? And we're like, yeah, but I'm bringing everyone. And they went, yeah, okay. So they were all there, and it was a really good sort of atmosphere on the screen, and really good sort of Q&A afterwards as well. But I loved this film. When I saw it, I was really taken by it. I think it's got just some of the most beautiful cinematography of any film that year, and of any A24 film. I think it's probably up there with the likes of The Lighthouse and Moonlight for cinematography. I just was really taken by it. I didn't expect to be, but there was just something that, yeah, I just loved it. What about yourself?
I had a somewhat frustrating first time watching this one. So this was out in iTunes USA for months before a sort of London Film Festival. And I was always just thinking like, oh, that film is there. I would love to watch it, but I'm going to wait to see it in the cinema. And I was really confident it would play at London Film Festival. And obviously it did. But the problem was it screened 2 weeks before the film festival starts. So London really kind of spreads its films over the period. And I was like, oh, crap. So I'm not going to be able to see it, but maybe I'll get to see the public screening. And then the opportunity came up to sit down with Joe Talbot to talk about the making of the film. And I was like, crap. So I'm not probably going to be able to see the film before I interview him. And I want to obviously have some preparation for it. So I rented the film from iTunes USA sort of the day before I went down to London, watched it on my TV, thoroughly enjoyed it, and then went down to London and I got the chance to interview him. But I was lucky enough to then get the chance to get, I think it was like a rush ticket for a different screening to see the film eventually in the cinema. So it was kind of a relief but frustrating that I got to interview Joe, but I had to sort of watch the film on sort of like, you know, my TV instead of kind of getting to be blown away by seeing it in the cinema for the first time.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we've always been advocates for the cinematic experience, and that's always where I would want to watch something for the first time. Obviously, you know, especially if you get the chance, obviously with certain A24 films in the UK, it's pretty much iTunes or nothing. So therefore you kind of have to accept it. But I think this is one of those films that really sort of does benefit from the big screen experience. And I mean, how was it speaking to Joe, sort of teeing up your interview?
Yeah, Joe is someone that is so incredibly passionate about this film, his city and this project. And here's Joe kind of sitting down to talk about the making of The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
We're very lucky. I mean, the truth is, when we finished the film, finished it 4 days before Sundance, before the premiere, and so we went into Park City, which is high above altitude, and we're all sort of, you know, I think anxious and nervous to put this thing out in the world that we've been working on for 5 years at that point. And I wish I could say that I knew how people would respond. I think we thought that we made something that captured the city that Jimmy and I love, but you really don't know until you put it out there. So it's been really wonderful to see how it's been received and to talk to people afterwards, to hear stories from people that lived in San Francisco, or frankly from people who've never even been to San Francisco before, but are finding this connection with Jimmy because sadly, I think what's happening there is happening everywhere. That's been sort of this, it's both, as a filmmaker, it's rewarding, as a human, it's sad, because it means that we're all seeing the cities that raised us become less recognizable. And I think people that historically made those cities the special places they are, especially in San Francisco, which was a haven for artists, for people that didn't fit into their small towns from other conservative parts of the country, they arrived, you know, in San Francisco to be the person that they couldn't be elsewhere. And now the city that once welcomed those groups is driving many of them out in waves. And so, you know, I think it's nice that it can be a point of conversation, I think, for people that have lived in the city a long time, as well as people moving there. Perhaps it'll give them a little more insight into what was there before them.
How did you go about bringing this to the big screen?
Jimmy and I grew up together in San Francisco, and so it's an unusual movie in that way. He's playing a character that shares his name, and a lot of the movie is pulled from his life. It's also pulled from the lives of friends of ours. We're both multi-generational San Franciscans, so we grew up on the stories of our parents' San Francisco and our grandparents' San Francisco. For me, a lot of that was in the 60s and the Haves. And for Jimmy, just down the street, it was the story of, you know, how his grandfather had built this house. And that was what he was raised to believe. And I think especially when things got dark and the family that had all been huddled under one roof living together was dispersed after they lost the house, Jimmy really held on to that story as something that carried a lot of weight for him, you know. And so the movie is not just about the house, but we also wanted to work through the idea of family stories and what they mean to us when we're going through difficult times.
It was I think in reflection now, a very unusual process. For us, it didn't feel unusual because it was the only one we've ever known. But I think it's not typically how movies get made. Part of that is, so it stems from, as I was saying, the conversations that Jimmy and I had growing up in San Francisco and wanting to turn those into a film. But what began with just the two of us quickly expanded in the early stages to this like film family that came together around the film. And part of that was that, you know, I'm a high school dropout. Jimmy has never acted in anything other than my film. So we knew that we weren't the most bankable pair in the world when we're saying, hey, do you want to give us a couple million dollars to make this movie? Most people in their right minds wouldn't trust us. And so we shot a very funky concept trailer early on that was essentially a very cheap version of the opening sequence of the movie where he skates through the city. But in our concept trailer, Jimmy was telling his grandfather's story that inspired the film. And I shot it and edited it and scored it. We put it online. And it actually ended up being this accidental calling card where people started writing us, some from London actually, saying, like as I was saying, it's this universal story, and we hadn't been aware of that before. But for people that were a bit closer to San Francisco, we got a bunch of letters saying, how can we help make this movie? I mean, it really was like this kind of groundswelling around the film. I still meet people today that go, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I gave you $10 on Kickstarter. So it did really tip into something. We were fortunate. But I think, you know, the small group that formed around it, many of them were also Bay Area based artists who were struggling with the same things. How can I survive here? And they really threw all of themselves into the movie. It's one thing for me and Jimmy because we grew up together, but to have this group of people who are just meeting us for the first time, like devote so much of themselves to something, it really was an integral part of this film because not only was it difficult being a first film, but also San Francisco happens to be one of the hardest places in the entire country to make a film in. Very film averse. Not a lot of funding in general in the U.S. for narrative films. But beyond that, it can be very expensive. And so, much like the wealth gap that exists in San Francisco, you know, outside of filmmaking, the movies that come there are often either huge Marvel films that go to blow up the Golden Gate Bridge, or they're tiny indie films that are sneaking under the radar made for like $200,000. And we lived in this precarious place where we're nothing close to the Marvel movies, but we had a little bit more than the very tiny indies. And so it was a constant struggle that took this Herculean effort from everyone involved to figure out how we could do something that was, for our budget, pretty ambitious. We had a lot of exterior shots. We had a big cast, kind of built this family that all developed the story together. So we always almost like a writer's room. As we were writing, we were scouting locations and casting. So we found that for us, it was very helpful to do it that way, because we'd find a location we loved and we would end up writing it into the movie. So, for instance, I think initially probably in one of the first drafts, when Jimmy goes to see his dad, cut immediately to an interior. But we found this beautiful building with this stay sign on it. And so then we built the scene with this opera singer outside, who was someone else that we'd seen on one of our walks that we go on during our writing sessions, and we just start talking to him, and he influenced his character. So I feel like I enjoy that way of doing it, because I come from a family of journalists, and there was a sort of journalistic element to the research and the world building that we wanted to do, really trying to capture our San Francisco and archive it, because it's changing so quickly. Like, half the locations in the movie are unrecognizable at this point now, and we just shot a year ago, because it's changing that quickly. Like the housing projects, for instance, where Jimmy goes to the candy house in one brief scene, and the woman who runs the candy house is arguing with the guy at the front of the line. Those are very famous housing projects in San Francisco called Double Rock, and they've since been torn down. The area all around Montgomery's house looks very different. There are still groups that are fighting day and day to keep San Francisco this special, strange place that it has been for many years. I think what they're coming up against now are incredibly powerful forces, right? The money, there's never been money quite like this in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Even old San Francisco money is freaked out, you know? The Pacific Heights crowd, which is like where the old money in San Francisco was for a long time, I think they are not crazy about what's happening, which is kind of says a lot. It's tech. So San Francisco, you have outside of the Twitter headquarters, you'll find people with needles in their arms. And some tech workers who are moving there are probably appalled and want to understand what's happening. Many who you see, if you just were to go there on a random day and watch, will be stepping over people who are nodding off. And even worse, occasionally writing angry blog posts about the human feces on the ground. Rather than trying to understand who the human is that the feces came from, someone that may have lived in San Francisco long before you, may have even lived in an apartment that you were in and got pushed out themselves, it's like there's an apathy that I think is really invading the spirit of San Francisco. And it was not that way. Like, it used to be when we were growing up, you know, I knew all the homeless people in my neighborhood. You see them around the park. They're a part of your community. They're not a nuisance. Now they're treated like this despicable thing that no one wants to touch or to engage with. And so people pretend that they don't exist. Someone can be shouting on the streets in need of help, or sometimes just looking for someone to talk to. People walk by like nothing's happening.
Did you have like any concerns as a white man telling this story about the black community in San Francisco?
I think when you're talking about historically black films that have been made by white directors, I think that it's really important. It's a good question to ask, like, what is this director's connection to the story, right? And so I think it's a totally reasonable thing. I'd probably wonder the same things if I saw the film and then looked it up and saw that I had directed it. I think that in our case, it's really important that it comes out of a collaboration. And so it's not just me coming in, helicoptering in, and telling the story that I don't have any connection to. Jimmy and I growing up together in San Francisco, having a trust that not only as like a white man and a black man, but also as people that have known each other for a long time, have shared very intimate stories with each other, long before we ever started thinking about, oh, we want to make a film. I think that connection was very critical, because it's not just his experience, again, as an African-American San Franciscan, it's his actual life, right? Really imbued into the film. The scene with his mother is actually his mother. It's a very, and they have a very specific relationship, you know? So I think that, you know, you should also ask Jimmy that question as well, because he can speak more to what that was like from his perspective. But from mine, it was important to really make sure that we were creating something together. And that went beyond just me and Jimmy. I think that extended to our whole team, which was a very diverse team. And, you know, my other partner, other than Jimmy on the film, creatively, was my lead producer, Kalia.
Lovely.
So Kalia Neal is from Oakland, which is right across the bay. Her family and her mom's side's from Hunters Point, where Montgomery lives in San Francisco. And Kalia is someone that reached out and took a big risk on us very early on. I would love for Kalia to get more shout-outs. If you guys are looking to write about a heroic producer, I mean, she reached out to us when we had very little recognition, long before A24 and Plan B came on, and helped us, like, actualize it. She was working with me in years for Isolation in San Francisco to figure out how we could turn this into a film. And Kalia, as my producing partner, we made every decision together. And so I think it's important that, like, it's not just on Jimmy's shoulders to sort of, like, shoulder that whole experience, but really as a team, hoping that the way that we work collaboratively, developing the story together, making sure that all decisions feel like there's conversations around it, there's an openness, that that's, like, a part of the storytelling, so it's not just from me.
You bring this beautiful house, the skateboard, inanimate objects to life incredibly well in this film. How did you achieve this so that the audience becomes really invested in them?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we would joke that Jimmy's skateboard is like his horse. You know, he's like a cowboy. He rides off into the sunset. Where he lays his hats is home. And when he breaks that skateboard, it's not just this inanimate object. It has deep meaning for him, because historically, you know, and this is true in Jimmy's life as well, outside the film, it's like the skateboard is your way into different parts of San Francisco that you might not otherwise go to. It's like San Francisco was sort of a skate mecca in the 90s and early 2000s when we were growing up. And when Jimmy started skateboarding, he said he saw different parts of the city than he knew existed. So that was, that held a special importance.
The cinematography and the music design in this film is incredible and really adds to it. Can you tell me a little bit about that as well?
Man, like, I met two lifetime collaborators when we started making this film. One in Adam, our cinematographer. I met Adam 10 days before we shot the film. It was pandemonium. I had another DP who had shot a short that was going to do it. We lost him at the last second. And Adam stepped in and was a hero. I mean, we were shooting crazy long days and then shot listing at night when he should have been sleeping. He could have very well come in this, like, under great duress at the last minute and had every excuse to, like, carve out some time for himself to be a human being. But he's so deeply obsessed and focused on, like, wanting to make sure everything feels right. At one point when he and I were sort of, like, in the throes of, like, pre-production, it was getting scary, we're 2 days out, we were sort of going back and forth, and he stopped me and he was like, I just want to make sure that I really honor this story, because I know you and Jimmy have been living with it your whole life. And I think every bit of passion he brings to it is, like, comes out of that. Like, it's a deep respect. So he's a special person. Really, really special. And Emil is similarly obsessive about his craft. Emil had never scored a feature film before, but he wanted to make a score that he felt was out of, he always says, Jimmy's heart. And so it's orchestral and almost like the music he wrote for the house. He always said he wanted to feel church-like, with the organs that are built in there and it being this sort of holy place for Jimmy in some ways. So I feel so lucky. Those guys made my dreams come true, and I feel like they really, it's a hard thing on a small budget to shoot San Francisco in that way and to make it sound the way that Emil does. And there aren't many people that could have done that, even accomplished DPs and composers.
What's it like to be added to sort of the A24 filmography and their list of sort of first-time feature directors?
Yeah, A24, it's an honor. I mean, they take huge risks, you know, and they really, I think, want, like, directors, they empower directors to, like, tell the stories they want to tell. I think a lot of people say they do that, and very few do. So there aren't many people I could imagine making this movie if not them.
So there we go, there's Joe Talbot, and I don't think anyone can begrudge his sort of enthusiasm and passion for San Francisco, I suppose. No one can criticize it, you know, unless you kind of live there. So yeah, a real pleasure to interview Cho, and I think he's going to be an exciting filmmaker to watch. So, you know, you touched on it, this is a stunning kind of looking film. What makes this film so special for you, Dallas?
I mean, I think I knew I was going to love this film from about 3 minutes into the film, when it's sort of like this opening sort of credit sequence where sort of Jimmy and his friend sort of get on the skateboard and sort of basically skateboard through San Francisco to this house that his granddad owns and used to own, and it's just that sequence where the cinematography of it, the music, the sort of slow-mo shots, the sort of the people just going about their day in San Francisco, sort of turning and reacting to them on the skateboard and stuff. It was just from that moment on, I was hooked, and I was like, yes, I'm definitely gonna love this film. And I thought the performances were fantastic, especially Jonathan Majors, his friend. I thought he was his mom. I think he was absolutely fantastic, and I'm very excited to see what he's got coming up. I know he's one of the leads in the new Spike Lee film, The Five Bloods, that's coming out in June. So I'm very excited to see where his career goes. I mean, it's clear that they've got a passion for San Francisco, and I think what was interesting about the film is it showed off a different side of San Francisco than what I've seen in the past. I'm just thinking of the likes of The Rock and Vertigo and even The Room, which basically is, you know, you've got to have establishing shots of the Golden Gate Bridge, you've got, you know, tram cars and stuff like that, but, you know, there was very little of that. It sort of showed a different side of it, and I mean, that's what the sort of film's about. It's about the sort of gentrification and then regentrification of a city where it's your home but you don't feel at home in it, and it's about trying to find your place within it, and I thought that was really something really special.
Yeah, I what I found somewhat depressing about the film as well is that, you know, separate to the film, is me and you, we've spoken about this before, we love to visit locations from the films that we see and go to, and with this one I felt so sorry for them, because this film comes out sort of, you know, middle of last year for most people, the UK later in the year. People are probably going to discover this as sort of a word of mouth film. And so many of these locations, you think, oh, I would love to visit that or see that, or what a stunning little spot that was. When I was kind of listening to the audio commentary and in my interview with Joe, he talks about some of these places have already gone. They've been converted and changed. They are missing. And it used to be that you'd have a sort of film where you would go, that is sort of like trapped in amber. That location is going to be there for years and years. Something like, say, the fire station, and something like Ghostbusters. And obviously that's kind of changed in recent years. Now you've got it where a film like this is somewhat out of date so quickly. And, you know, the film's important message about sort of like preserving what we've got, that kind of community as well, you know, as we sort of move into kind of a more Airbnb society in terms of what people are buying over, you know, landlords kind of buying up properties, pushing people that are born and bred salt of the earth people from a city outwards. It's so sad that some of that last black man in San Francisco is gone already, which adds even more to sort of the tragic message at the heart of the film as well.
Yeah, no, I mean, we kind of touched on it when on Filibuster, when we were talking about my book on New York film locations, and I wrote that in 2015, and yeah, it's already sort of out of date, because certain bars and restaurants are already closed. I mean, everything's closed in New York at the moment, but when they reopen, I mean, yeah, there's a few bars like Schiller's and stuff like that, which are really great places, but it's just the kind of, it's just the nature of the beast that these places sometimes have a bit of a short shelf life, and it's sad to see that certain locations are already gone. But I expect that house in particular, even though I think from what I can gather is the outside of the house and the inside of the house might be different houses, but I mean, it's certainly one. I know that Jimmy and Joe have, for the A24 shop, they did a San Francisco map, sort of walking tour, sort of guide thing, so you can sort of the locations that are still left, you can still go around. So if you're ever on buying candles or basketball shorts, then you can always pick up a San Francisco tour guide at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that stands out for this film, and you picked up obviously on the performances, is the cinematography and the soundtrack to this. I think this is certainly, if we were to do like an A24 award ceremony when we maybe get to sort of the end of sort of the line, which is getting quite close really at the moment, this would definitely be one of the best looking and sounding films of the filmography. It feels like a fairy tale and sort of captures a very, you know, unique place. You know, we both come from places that we love as well, and I think that they shoot San Francisco in such a beautiful and stunning way in this film. What did you make of sort of the sound design and cinematography, Dallas?
I mean, the cinematography is fantastic, what I said, but yeah, the score as well I thought was brilliant. And I'm just going to bring up who it was because I've forgotten to check that beforehand. Emile Mosseri, yeah, his score is just beautiful in this film. Really sort of good, very sort of orchestral and classic, which you maybe wouldn't expect given the characters involved. You know, you've got this sort of gang who hang around on the street corner who seem like they'd be very much into hip-hop and stuff like that, but it goes against the grain because, you know, Jimmy's from, you know, this sort of lower working class background, but he used to live in this grand house in San Francisco and is looking to get it back, to claim it back. So you can see this juxtaposition. So that in that respect, it really works. And I just love the sort of a cappella version of If You're Going to San Francisco. And it's by the singer who also did the vocals on I've Got Five on It, which he actually does very, very briefly in the film. I didn't realise that was actually him. I just thought he was singing that for a laugh, but then it turns out he was actually the singer on that song. That's a classic as well, and that was really good. And yeah, it's just got so many beautiful musical moments that go along with the, yeah, like you say, it's definitely score wise and probably cinematography wise, it's probably definitely sort of top five for me, I think.
One, we're obviously not just fans of this film, but I was recently sat down for a little chat with Kelechi Iyanulu to discuss her perspective on The Last Black Man in San Francisco. So let's hear from her.
If you're going to San Francisco.
So welcome to the show, Kelechi. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on today. How's your kind of lockdown been going so far?
First and foremost, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be here and talk about The Last Black Man in San Francisco. I guess in the very strange and surreal and difficult circumstances that we all find ourselves in, you know, I guess on a personal level, I can say that, you know, I'm fine, I'm healthy, and the same goes for friends and family that I know. But also very consciously aware of, you know, others are having a hard time as well, you know, with something I certainly can relate to, be it, you know, whether it's financial hardship or, you know, financial hardship or social hardship, because I'm sure we all miss going to the cinema and doing all those everyday activities, you know. So, you know, I hope once we see the light of day, and the, you know, we find some return back to some normalcy, we, you know, we learn to love a little, you know, treat each other with some kindness, love each other better, and, you know, to the people who've kept the country running, you know, hope they get all pay rises because they deserve it.
Absolutely. I mean, you touched on it there. We're going to talk about the Last Black Man in San Francisco. I mean, sort of in lockdown, it feels like a lifetime ago in so many ways. That kind of last year we met at the 2019 London Film Festival, and I mentioned the door was always open to you, and I think you had just seen The Last Black Man in San Francisco when you were like, if you ever do that, reach out to me. And we were true to our word. We have long kind of memories here.
I'm glad you remembered me to do that, because it's funny because it feels like a very, very long time ago. And, you know, I was just very honored to be part of, you know, London Film Festival, because, you know, it's for a press and as a film critic as well, for me, you know, it's always a dream come true to do those you know, film festivals. So the opportunity to go and see that film, you know, and see and be overwhelmed by the emotion that it gave to me was, you know, a dream come true. And pretty much any, you know, whoever, whether it was you or whether any other film critic that I bumped into, I was literally just saying, you guys need to go and see The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
So before you kind of saw The Last Black Man in San Francisco in London, had you heard about the film? What were your kind of expectations going into it? And what made you pick that film, sort of, when you go to these film festivals? A film like Last Black Man in San Francisco could be up against 3 or 4 other press screenings, or it might be up against some big UK premiere in Leicester Square and sort of the public screenings. What did you expect going in, and what made you pick it?
So I first heard about it, you know, again, like as you said, in, you know, last year at London Film Festival, but it was actually earlier than that, probably around the summer, when I, you know, I follow a couple of US-based film critics online, and I think it had just debuted at Sundance, and it may have won some awards then, I think. And, you know, they left the cinema, or left the screening, I should say, in complete awe, and was mesmerized and just immersed in that experience that Joe Talbot created. So that was my initial reaction. It's like, okay, this online reaction seems very serious, and, you know, I definitely want to be, you know, the opportunity, whether it was at a film festival, because at that time I didn't know it was going to be confirmed at London Film Festival, but it was on the radar for me to kind of like, okay, I want to check this film out.
When you kind of went into the film, what was your kind of first reaction as you're kind of watching this unfold? Was it what you expected? Were you surprised? And what was it like kind of coming out of that screening?
Oh yeah, so, you know, besides the online reaction that I saw, it's amazing that I kind of went into it completely blind. So I knew about the online reaction, but I almost forgotten about it by the time it was announced at London Film Festival. You know, so I didn't know that it was, at the time, it was Joe Talbot's feature length, you know, directorial debut. You know, I didn't know it was based on a true story. I didn't know, you know, Jimmy Fails was playing a loose version of himself in the field of film. And I didn't even see the trailer. So, and, you know, for, I guess for most film critics, you know, where we're, you know, relying on so much information to help us understand you know, the film's going to be about, what to expect. You know, me going in completely blind, I was able to just ignore all of the, any kind of expectations. So I had zero expectations. I just knew that from the online reaction, it was probably going to be very moving and, you know, and very personal. So I was able to kind of just immerse in that experience and just acknowledge it. And that for me is always the best cinematic experience. And when I left the cinema, I was completely overwhelmed with emotion. Like, I cried. And even when I rewatched it recently, I had the exact same feeling. And that's because how that film managed to cut so deep with its subtext, and how it conveyed it so beautifully. You know, it's a film that is very much about friendship in a city, and that's in the cusp of change, but it's also a poignant love letter to San Francisco. It's about gentrification, it's about ownership and belonging, it's about communities and how they are the heartbeat of the city, and even under lockdown conditions it seems more resonating now than it ever did before. You know, it's about class divide and rich and poor, aspects of male masculinity and creativity in history. And for a film to kind of mesh all of that emotions together, I was completely like mind blown. I was overwhelmed. And for a film that does that, you know, I you know, I'm probably doing a bit of a hatchet job and trying to explain it, because that's what happens when you love a film so much and you're trying to find the words to articulate it the best way you can. But I just don't think there are enough words to convey how good it is. You know, in my review, I talked about it as like the masterpiece for the soul, because of those authentic and realistic and passionate portrayals that it underpins it with this beautiful friendship with between Jimmy Fails and Montgomery, who's played by Jonathan Majors. And, you know, it's, for me, was just an unforgettable experience. that somehow managed to speak louder than words. Because in this era where we are living in is of gentrification, where these stories are being, you know, community stories are being erased for, you know, these brand new sparkling polished monoliths of, you know, coffee shops and flats and all these things that feel like monoliths at the moment, where you feel like it's, you know, it's things that you can dream about and you're trying to attain, but sometimes you're never in the right, you know, whether it's economic class or whether it's a social class or whatever it is. It's a film for me that spoke deeply because of it's how much, you know, as much as you're getting something brand new, is something is lost in the process. And I think that was probably the most, you know, striking thing that took my emotions away. So that's an experience.
The film is predominantly starring black actors, co-written by Jimmy Fails himself. What do you kind of feel about this film? That what do you think it says perhaps about kind of race and what people may face in kind of America, that people like myself in Dallas, you know, as white men, we might not ever be able to kind of relate to or pull from the film?
You know, it's funny, I can't really speak for every, you know, person in the black community, you know, because, you know, all of our struggles and our experiences are different. But there is, you know, the shared empathy of, you know, we're trying to do better. We're trying to get out of whether it's, you know, poverty, whether it's, you know, a better job placement, whether it's, you know, financial or in that kind of struggles. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, strikes deeply with the film is there's a great scene at the beginning where Jimmy and Mont are skateboarding down, you know, past their local communities and then right into downtown in San Francisco. And they are almost immediately judged for being there because, you know, obviously they're two, you know, guys on a skateboard, which obviously is like, you know, strange enough, as in, you know, it's always one person that's on a skateboard. But it's strange in the sense that, you know, for a city that is changing in monster gentrification, you know, they are judged for not, like, you don't belong there, you need to go to somewhere else. And it becomes like a part of Talbot's, you know, striking emphasis on that displacement. And you can take that back to even things like, you know, times of slavery, in terms of like Jim Crow, in terms of, you know, segregation, and how, you know, black achievements, black excellence, black, you know, accomplishments and things like that, where we are, you know, systematically erased out of it. So it feels like we don't have, you know, a sense of ownership, or we don't have things to celebrate, or we don't things, you know, culturally reflected in what we're doing. And it's always coming from, I guess, a white perspective, in terms of achievements, in terms of, you know, and things that we look up to. So that idea of what, you know, The Last Black Man in San Francisco does so, you know, so deeply is convey that sense of trying to break free out of the stereotypical aspects of our society and culture, and trying to rise above it and believing in your dreams and believing in yourself and believing in creativity as your markers, as the way to get out.
One thing I was curious about, what was your thoughts on, say, Joe Talbot, for example? I was surprised when I first saw sort of the trailers and kind of some of the footage for the film. I was very surprised that it was a white man, essentially, that was the director of this kind of film and also the kind of co-writer. Was that an issue for you, or did sort of Joe Talbot kind of bridge the gap in a way?
You know, it's strange because, you know, I never thought of it in that way. As in, you know, I don't judge directors based on race or on what they do. It comes down to the merit of the story. And the fact is that the story started off as Joe Talbot and the real life Jimmy Fails being childhood friends and knowing San Francisco like the back of their hand. And he was able to, you know, co-write together with Jimmy to bring that story to life. For me, it's how it's directed, I think, is, you know, I think it shows a level of, you know, I would call it the Barry Jenkins effect. You know, there was aspects where I was watching, I was thinking, did Barry Jenkins direct this? Because, you know, it's touching upon the same, you know, direction is touching upon the same, you know, getting up and close and personal with a lot of extreme close-ups. So therefore, you're seeing characters who are completely unfiltered. You can't escape away from their raw emotions. You're basically invading their personal spaces, and you're seeing them in their truth, basically. And he was able to direct that with a lot of subtext, but convey that not just through exposition, because exposition is just a cheap way of just trying to get from A to B, but he's able to do that visually and express that almost, you know, in almost like a dreamland and fantasy, you know, and surreal. So, you know, for his debut feature film, that is, again, is awe-inspiring, because it just shows you that, you know, it's, you can communicate like that with film and touch something upon that's personal. And he's, you know, a bit like Mont in the film, you know, using, you know, the stories and the creativity that surrounds you, you can create something that is beautiful as that. And that's something that really resonated with me.
I'm curious as well, obviously you are someone that kind of, you know, hails from London. Is there a lot of parallels that can be drawn between sort of London and San Francisco with what we see in the film, that London, much like my kind of city, Edinburgh, is something that's becoming more challenging for people to live in, that are kind of born and bred here, and there's this sort of huge push towards this Airbnb style apartment, denying people the chance to live and work within the city that they were born into?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can say for hand on heart, you know, living in London, you know, rents are going up. Pretty much everything is going up except for people's salaries. You're seeing pretty much everywhere, you know, I live in North London, which is just under rapid scale development. You're seeing luxury apartments and buildings pretty much. You know, if you went by, you know, a couple of record stores that used to be there when you used to grow up and you know, listen to music, that's now been, you know, turned, you know, closed down and been turned into a luxury apartments that, you know, is out of people's price range. And what's happening is that people are, unfortunately, are getting pushed out of the area to, you know, and finding themselves, I guess, commuting into the area just to earn a living. So it's, you know, the epicenter, unfortunately, is of the country. You're seeing it in a lot of house prices going up. You're seeing it in, like I said before, the luxury apartments. You're seeing it into these amazing amenities that are being built, which is, you know, great in terms of, you know, I guess if you're giving your local communities a refresh and getting more people into the community to kind of work or take value or interest into the community. But at the same time with gentrification, you're losing the people who made that community in the first place. So you're losing the people who, you know, gave you a great smile and, you know, gave you great smiles, who, you know, gave you that you can have a conversation with, you know, the people who just literally made your day, or even the people who you just didn't know. You know, these are people who are the heartbeat of those communities, and that's something that is, you know, unfortunately eradicating away. You know, it's the same, you know, I remember a couple of years ago back in Tottenham Court Road, where it used to be like an epicenter of, you know, independent computer chain shops where you can get things like fixed and repaired, and now it's just full of, you know, chain stores. You know, again, is there anything wrong with that? No, but it's, again, you're erasing a lot of things that made up that area and what they need to do. And I guess, you know, true to the spirit of what The Last Black Man in San Francisco echoes, you know, it's up to us, you know, the people who were there, to remember those places, because if we don't tell the story, who will?
One thing I found quite sad, sort of, from I interviewed Joe Talbot at London Film Festival, and then I'd seen the film a couple of times. I thought, you know what, I'm going to listen to the audio commentary instead. And what I found so sad was that in a film that only came out 14 months ago, if people were wanting to perhaps check out some of these locations in San Francisco that they beautifully shoot, kind of make like fairy tale kind of visuals about, some of them are already gone and kind of replaced within such a kind of rapid change of time. It's so sad that, like, this film in a way is, you know, a legacy to something that's gone, but in a way the film has already sort of been partially kind of replaced already.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said before, it's a love letter to the city, and it's you know, if you think about to even something like the soundtrack, you know, it's very solemn, it's very haunting. You know, it's Emil Mosseri did the soundtrack, which I highly recommend. If you've got Spotify or iTunes, buy it, play it, listen to it on repeat. And it becomes, you know, it's like almost like the way Joel Talbot directs it, it's almost like a city that's in mourning. You know, you're looking at a city that used to be, and then now a city that's changing, that's, again, as I mentioned before, is creating its own new, you know, new safe haven, new haven or something like that, you know. You know, it's such a, it does it in such a way that, you know, it makes you really appreciate a lot of the things that, you know, that goes into making, you know, a city, and then, you know, acknowledging the things that unfortunately are just out of our control.
What are some of your personal highlights of the film, like whether it's moments, cues, lines? What are some of your favourite beats, Sam Kelechi?
I think for me, it's, you know, I aspire with Jimmy and Mont. Jimmy for, you know, for keeping the dream alive. You know, obviously I don't want to spoil it for audiences, but you know, there are things where he's very, you know, very resolute, and he's trying to make the dream to happen. And with Mont as a writer, and how he tries to, you know, keep creativity alive, you know, he's using the environment that he's inspired by. He's you know, reciting plays, he's reciting conversations, noting them down in a notebook. As a writer myself, you know, those are the things that resonate because of that. You know, he's become like an almost an ambassador for the community. And you know, it's through those I guess internal conversations, you know, like it's the struggles that he recognizes, you know, it's finding those creative spaces to create, but also knowing you have to balance the time to, you know, with, you know, jobs that you may not enjoy, to keep that dream alive, to keep the spirit alive. And, you know, I identify with when, you know, obviously I've not worked in the Fishmongers, but, you know, when he's in the Fishmongers and Jimmy's like, how's the writing going? And it's coming along. You know, these are the things that you know, as a writer, you deal with on a daily basis, and to trying to find the, I guess, the spirit, the art and the soul of your piece, so it resonates with a lot of people. And that balance and the duality of that struggle, you know, how he represents the culture and the beauty of the city that's, you know, in jeopardy of being lost, you know, and he documents that the best he can. That is something that I think all writers inspire to. And, you know, for Jimmy, who, you know, acts with, I would say, a Mahershala Ali quality, you know, has this amazing patience, and says a lot with, you know, with a lot of his facial expressions, just to kind of keep that dream going, basically.
We pose this question to everyone we get onto to the podcast. What are some of the highlights of the A24 filmography for you? And what's your, you know, opinion of them as sort of a kind of blogger and film writer?
I guess with A24, I love them for being the alternative to the modern day, you know, cinema, you know, like the MCU, the franchise tentpole cinema films that we get pretty much inundated on a constant basis. And I love that A24 are a company that always tries to find, I guess, the humanity in their stories. You know, they're always stories that come from a personal aspect, and they're always driving that to make you connect with it. And it's films that you know, just like The Last Black Man in San Francisco, it always reminds you of why cinema was invented, for because of those soulful films. So films like, you know, Waves, which again I saw at London Film Festival, you know, it's, you know, that again, I probably don't have the right words to kind of articulate that as why as to love it, but it's another film that hits you hard with the emotion, and yet is again another film that captures the spirit of life. You know, I love Barry Jenkins, and I love Moonlight. And these are the films, again, like Moonlight, like Waves, like The Last Black Man in San Francisco, you know, I look at them as films as part of that emerging Black renaissance of films that just go beyond, you know, cultural stigmas that, you know, Black films get subjected to, whether they're just, or characters get subjected to, whether they're looked as like, you know, pimps or gangsters or slaves, and then just finding stories that just find the nuance and the beauty in between those stories. So Moonlight is definitely one of them as my faves. And I'm not necessarily the biggest horror fan, but I loved what Ari Aster did with Hereditary, and I recently watched Midsommar and it scared the crap out of me. So you know, there's a lot of, I just love how they're able to find something relatable that is, you know, that becomes the anchor for their stories. It's not to say those big franchise films do not contain it or anything like that, but I, you know, there's something, the way A24 goes about those films, that resonates a lot more to the psyche and just gives a great variety of films, basically.
You speak so well about the Last Black Man in San Francisco and everything, really. If people wanted to kind of dive into your kind of writing, your podcast you might have been on, where's the kind of best place to seek out your work and perhaps kind of follow you online?
So you can follow me at K.E. Henulo, or at Geek Mind UK. That's both on Twitter. If you're interested in, you know, my works, you can go on confessionsfromageekmind.com. And I also write for Vulture Hound magazine and Set the Tape.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and hopefully we can have you again on in the future. It's been a real pleasure to hear your thoughts on the Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Thank you very much, Lee. It's a real pleasure, and you know, to get the chance to talk about something like this, you know, I know it's only a short segment, but it's still one of the real pleasures and one of the best films I've seen from last year. For me, it deserved every award that it could get. Unfortunately, it didn't get the award season love, but we all know what the real winner was.
Be sure to wear flowers in your hair.
So thanks very much to Kelechi for joining me. Hopefully she'll join us again in the future. Her clear enthusiasm and passion for the film is certainly palatable. And if we don't convince you to check it out, you know, you've got to listen to her too. So yeah, definitely check out her work, and thanks to very much for her for joining us. With this kind of film as well, with Joe Talbot, you know, a very kind of exciting sort of debut film, were you stunned that this was his first film when you watched it?
Oh, absolutely. This is an incredibly well accomplished film. You know, there's control over every scene. He knows exactly what he wants, what he's doing. Nothing felt sort of rushed or haphazard. He has a vision, and he's accomplished it. You know, himself and Jimmy worked on the script, and it's an incredibly sort of powerful script, especially with, I mean, this is probably one of those ones which is quite out of scene, so I'm not wanting to tip my hand too much, but there's kind of a reveal that sort of, there's almost two reveals actually, but the reveal that sort of comes sort of halfway through that puts a different perspective on it is, it's heartbreaking, and then it's almost double heartbreaking when you find out the other one, and it was really quite unexpected, and I just thought it was, yeah, they're clearly very, very talented, and I think he's got a really sort of bright future ahead of him.
Yeah, I don't think we also won't touch on sort of the spoiler reveal, but I think it's safe to say The Last Black Man in San Francisco is a film of two halves, about getting the house and then getting into the house. Obviously, I very much felt like the first half of the film was definitely the strongest for me. What did you make of sort of this story of two halves, or did you feel that was the case at all?
I really liked where it went. I thought it was a really sort of interesting take, and I kind of liked the... There's almost like that moment where in a film where someone sort of basically, you get the name of the film in the film, and Mont in order to sort of connect with the house and connect with Jimmy again. They've kind of had a bit of falling out. He's wanted to be this actor, and he writes all these different plays and stuff like that, and he does voices and stuff, and he puts on a play in the attic of this house where he has to break some bad news to Jimmy, and also looking at the death of one of their friends as well. And I thought that was I just loved that moment. I thought it was a really sort of powerful way to get the message across. And of course, his play is called The Last Black Man in San Francisco. So at that point, you could have gone, hey, everyone stands up, claps, and then the film ends. But I thought it was really, I know a couple of people maybe felt, maybe it's not entirely in keeping with what's come before, but I really like the way that they sort of pushed the boundaries with that section of it. And yeah, I even appreciated the ending, which I can't say what happens in the ending, but it reminded me of another film featuring made by a pair of best friends from in 1997 that won an Academy Award or two.
Yeah, I was stunned when you told me that the other day. You know, so you might be someone like me that'll have seen it like three times, never picked up on it. Like I was like, when I got your message, I was like, huh, that's all. I sort of put it into the internet, and then I was sat there mind blowing. But I think one thing we can say about that scene is that it has a hell of a beautiful kind of closing line and so on, and one that's been a real standout is that you know the bus is packed with these, you know, couple of young women that are talking about how crap San Francisco is, and then sort of Jimmy kind of makes the point of like, you know, you can't criticize, you know, a place. I need to get the line up because I will absolutely butcher it. So
you can't hate it if you don't love it. So basically, yeah, you need to love something in order to be able to hate it. Otherwise, you know, you can be indifferent to it, but you can't hate it if you don't love it.
And I thought, like, that's one of these most kind of profound kind of lines as well from sort of the filmography so far. I think that's so true. I mean, we both kind of grew up in and around sort of the same place. And, like, Aberdeen has its critics. People kind of throw it under the bus, you know, talking about how grey and depressing it can be. And, you know, I was very happy to get away from that city and so on. But, like, if I hear someone criticising it or the area, I'm like... Yep. No. I can criticize it for A, B, and C. You do not have the right or the authority to do that and stuff. It as soon as he said that, I was like, that's so true. Like, he perfectly encapsulates how I feel about sort of perhaps where I came from.
Yeah, it's just a funny thing, isn't it? You know, you'll moan about, oh, I can't believe what they're doing. They say, oh, can you believe they closed this down, blah, blah, blah. I hate it. And then if someone says, oh, yeah, it's terrible what they're doing, you go, hey, oh, no, don't you slag off my city. But you were just slagging it off. It's like, no, you're not allowed to. I live here. It's okay for me to do it, but no, you can't do it. So, yeah, no, it's completely spot on in what it does. Yeah, it's so true of how people act. It's like, yeah, they'll slag something off, but as soon as someone else does it, they're very, very protective over it.
Yeah, so I think it's safe to say these are two pretty underrated A24 films, and I think we'd both encourage people to check them out. I mean, they have some of the best twists and surprises of some of the A24 films that we've kind of reviewed so far, and I'd love to have kind of dived into them a little bit more, but you want to kind of make this a podcast as well, where it's not just diving into the big films and so on, but you also want to encourage people to check out these films if they've certainly not, and I think these are two that I hope people will check out in lockdown.
Yeah, no, I think there's ones like your Uncut Gems or your Hereditaries where you can guarantee that pretty much everyone has seen, and therefore it's okay to go into minute detail on all the sort of twists and turns. But some like Little Black Man in San Francisco, I think it got a very limited release in UK cinemas, sort of end of October time. So I think, yeah, it's one which will be flying under the radar for a lot of people. And I think, yeah, the more people, they'll eventually discover it, and when they do, I think they will love it as much as I did.
Yeah, so next week we are joined, we're going to be talking about two films that are kind of the complete opposite of what we've spoken about today, underseen and underrated films. We are going to be watching the kind of, you know, much seen Midsommar and the critically acclaimed The Farewell. So are you looking forward to this double bill?
Absolutely. I just wish that Midsommar had maybe come like a couple of episodes later and we'd actually reviewed it on the Midsommar. I mean, that would have been some timing, but it just hasn't worked out that way. But I'm getting my bear head costume ready. Unfortunately, I didn't win that or the May Queen dress on the A24 auction, so it looks like I'm going to have to make my own.
Yeah, I wonder who bought that for $64,000. Did Ariana Grande have the winning bid in the end?
I guess we'll have to wait until someone pops up on Instagram wearing it.
Absolutely. So thanks very much to everyone for joining us this week, and we'll speak with you all again soon. Take care.